It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Sozi!
No, that's Matthew Sozi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sozi.
I'm on right now. I don't believe you.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. Joining me behind the board, a gentleman who apparently is just going to add sound clips after my name. At the beginning of the show.
Yep.
And who is running straight to the arena tonight to watch the Pacers play the Bulls, Kobe Slagle.
That's right.
Welcome. Film Yap, Christopher Lloyd, and author of Reeling Back. Did I say it right? Yeah, I said it right.
Reeling Backward.
Reeling Backward. I knew that. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And, you know what? I without giving away too much, I think a solid week of movies for the most part.
For January,
there has to be kind of an asterisk, because yeah. January is that combination of films that were released at the end of December in bigger cities for Oscar consideration, and then it kind of trickles down to Indianapolis, and there are two examples of that rule today, this week, and then the movies that are released in January for a reason, and we'll get to those in a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, two of the films we're going to start with. Just a little inside info. The last couple of years, the doughy white guys with glasses and Gina, we've had press screenings in the morning, which we commonly do. But in the winter, we've been getting back-to-back screenings. We had a couple of those last year. We had a couple this year. For instance, one morning we watched The Fighter and then True Grit. And then the next day, I was not at this, so you have to verify the order. Was it The King's Speech and The Company Men?
I think so.
Okay. So, and it's very important where the films fall as far as the day. Last year, we saw The Lovely Bones and Up in the Air, and then we watched A Single Man and then Nine. And we thank God it was not in reverse, because that would just be a long, long day. Here are two films that we are really thankful we did not have to watch in the same day, those being Blue Valentine and Rabbit Hole, sure enough. So Blue Valentine is a new drama with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams as a couple who you see at the end of their marriage as it's starting to really fall apart, and it goes back and forth to when they first meet. And even in the early flashbacks when things seem blissful, little signs, little nuggets of bad marriage karma are coming.
You got any, like, talents?
Like, hidden talents?
Can you dance? You can tap dance?
Can you?
No. Here, I'll play a song and you dance. Okay. I can't really sing. I have to sing goofy in order to sing. Like, I have to sing stupid. Okay?
Okay.
Dance to this part. And if I were old, your heart last night, It's because I love you.
That's a happy moment that you see in the film.
Thanks.
As if you couldn't tell, Captain Obvious Theater here. I'm a big fan of the films of John Cassavetes. Now, this is, of course, the man that gave us films like A Woman Under the Influence, Faces, Shadows, Opening Night, Husbands, and it's very... It seems improvised, but it actually isn't, which is probably the most impressive aspect of it. And then really great performances by the likes of Jenna Rollins, Peter Falk, Ben Gazzara, himself, Cassavetes himself. And ever since his death, it just seems like somebody has been trying to come up with a Cassavetes-type drama. Even his son Nick tried it with She's So Lovely, which at that time really looked like something that could have been done in 1973. This film, written and directed by Derek Cianfrance, and some of the stories that you've heard is the fact that Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling and the daughter, the girl who plays the daughter, lived together for like a month in between the flashbacks and the current scenes. And this is about as raw, an emotional story about marriage falling apart without turning into melodrama as one can get. Chris, your thoughts on Cassavetes and that kind of comparison with this film?
I'd say it's probably a pretty good comparison. You know, it's the sort of movie that, you know, people who just go to the multiplex every weekend are probably not all that familiar with.
Fun after watching it.
You know, there's not a lot of narrative. There's not a lot of story progression. It really is just sort of, this twisting, torturing spin of these characters, you know, what they're going through. And this, people have referred to it as being a time-shifting movie in that, you know, it's not actually like showing them over various stages of time.
No.
It's essentially two different time frames right when they first met and not that much into the future based on the age of the child, 6, 7, 8 years maximum.
Probably.
So, I mean, that's really not that long an amount of time in the course of a marriage. And to see how much things have, I don't want to say changed, because the beauty of the movie is that we see perfectly in these two time frames what's happening with this couple. And even in the beginning, when they're just having that magical falling in love moment there that we just heard, you can already start to see the seeds of doom have been planted and how they've sprouted, you know, in the time frame later.
And become deeper and deeper.
Seeds of doom.
You heard that. Kind of like what the Pacers are going to face. Hey, my team's not doing any better. They're not playing. They're not playing the Bulls tonight. That's a problem.
Yeah, and two, I think, of the best performances of the year for Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling.
You know, they're two really, really impressive young, as if, you know, we're artifacts. But I think you were saying off here, Ryan Gosling's 30?
Just turned 30, three or four weeks ago. And I think Michelle Williams is 28 or 29.
And hopefully both of them will be getting nominations number two for these.
I hope. You know, this movie was a huge, broke out big from Sundance, but, you know, hasn't even opened here. I don't think it even opens in Indianapolis till the last Friday of this month.
Actually opened today.
Today.
That's what we're talking about.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking of a different movie.
That's all right.
But it's just now opening here in Indianapolis. It's not opening, I know, in a lot of other markets. I was getting it confused with other cities where my stuff runs, because they told me they was opening the 28th. So I'm sorry, I got
freelance man of mystery here.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep Indianapolis and Sarasota straight
like
in my head.
Are you like a stepfather? What is? Who am I in the city?
Which city am I in?
That's all right.
But the point is, you know, a lot of people aren't even going to have this movie available to see until after the Oscar nominations have come out. And probably if you're not living in a big city, probably won't even hit a theater unless it actually does get some nominations.
And here's hoping it does. I mean, yeah, they're both really, really solid. And the fact that they've been able to pick and choose, they've not done the ridiculous blockbuster. The only one I can think of immediately was, I know Ryan Gosling did the kind of subpar thriller Fracture with Anthony Hopkins. But the guy holds his own with Anthony Hopkins. You know, yeah. And of course, he got the nomination for Half Nelson. And yes, every woman in this building and on the planet loves The Notebook, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What? Why?
Why?
Yeah.
because it's well, one written by Nicholas Sparks, two passionate love affair about somebody you can have. By the way, also directed by Nick Cassavetes. A lot of kissing in the rain, but no cakes out in the rain, and the fact that it makes South Carolina and Georgia beaches look like the most magical place on earth. Am I missing anything?
And the fact that it features a man who devotes half his life to a woman who he may not ever get.
And then they grow up and become James Garner and Jenna Rollins, which was actually the better half of that film, in my opinion.
I liked it. I liked that movie.
It was fine. It was all right. So anyway.
Really, yeah. Really terrific movie. And the thing I really liked most about it was that there's really no even attempt to sort of, you know, identify one person as the bad guy
no.
and one person as the good guy. They both have good and bad qualities to them as people and in terms of what's going on in this relationship. Tension between them in the older segment is that, you know, she's ambitious. She's looking to go places in her career and where she wants to live and what she wants to do.
And he likes to drink beer in the morning before going to work, which
right.
he's allowed to do.
And you know, and he says, you know, I think his job is at that point
house painting.
And he's been one of these guys. He's just had different blue collar jobs his whole life. And he has a line of dialogue in there where he says, where, you know, my job is not important to me. You know, my job is just a thing I do so that I can get back to you guys.
A little scary.
Yeah, a little scary. But, you know, on some levels, he's this guy where he, you know, he's not a bad guy. He sort of takes things for granted with his wife. But, you know, there's also some level where, you know, he's trying to give affection and it's not being returned. And he just doesn't know where to go with that. And you can't really blame her because she essentially sort of headed into this way too young and didn't know what she was getting into.
Especially when they get into the futuristic room. The other thing that this film is known for was at one point it had an NC-17 rating.
Yeah, for about 5 minutes.
For about 5 minutes, and then they and the reason why I think is because there's a sex scene that's not erotic.
Yeah,
it's a sex scene that's actually realistic. There's a scene where they go to a one of those theme motels that none of us know about at all. We've read about it in magazines. And online.
I've driven past them and laughed.
You too, and from the jungle room. But yeah. but it's one of those where it's not a piece of pornography. And but for some reason it got slapped with the dreaded NC-17, which, you know, I've been hitting the NCAA a little hard this year, especially with the King's speech. And this is another one where I'm like, what the hell are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, and if you watch it, I mean, it's very brief. It's not at all graphic in any way, shape, or form. It's sort of a simulated sex act. We won't get any more specific than that. And it. The comparison was actually made between this and a somewhat similar scene in Black Swan.
Swan in this film.
Yeah. although I won't miss an opportunity to slam Black Swan.
Oh, jeez.
At least in Blue Valentine, the people actually take their clothes off to have their sex scene. But
hey, beggars can't be choosers. I don't know what you're griping about.
Yeah. But yeah, I wouldn't worry about if you're worried about taking. I mean, I wouldn't take a 12-year-old kid to see this, but
and I wouldn't do to take a first date to this yeah. movie either.
But yeah, if you've got a mature, you know, teenager, 15, 16, 17-year-old, I wouldn't.
Yeah, you know, don't take a date and say, "Hey, that's you and me in about 6 years."
Definitely not first date material.
So, but that, all that being said, really well made, really well acted. Go check it out. As if seeing a film about a marriage, a coupling begin and a marriage falling apart isn't enough, now we come to Rabbit Hole, a nice family picture about a couple dealing with the accidental death of their 4-year-old child. Nicole Kidman, using her porcelain for good, not for evil this time, Aaron Eckhart, Diane Wiest, and it's directed by, of all people, James Cameron Mitchell, who gave us
right.
a moment in Short Bus that we really can't describe on the air. You're just going to have to trust us on this one.
Or lots of moments.
Well,
in Short
lots
Bus.
Of moments, but I'm thinking of one during the credits, which I know I can't talk about. And, of course, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So take a listen to this.
She visits me sometimes in dreams and tells me it's okay. That she's with God.
God had to take her. He needed another angel.
He needed another angel.
Why didn't he just make one? Another angel? I mean, he's God after all. Why didn't he just make another angel? Hmm?
Thank you. I forget that he's not here sometimes. Like maybe he's just hiding under the bed. He's gonna pop out like he used to do. He's trying to make things nice.
You can't. All right, I'm sorry. Things aren't nice anymore. Feels like maybe I don't feel badly enough for you. Maybe I'm not feeling enough.
Something's gotta change. I can't do this like this anymore. It's too hard.
Does it ever go away? No. At some point, it becomes bearable.
Space is infinite, and there are tons of yous out there, and there's tons of me's.
I like that thought. Somewhere out there, I'm having a good time. It's time to change your mind. You let love be your God.
The Rabbit Hole is based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning play, and I actually, and I don't review plays, but I got to see the production done at IRT, and of course the playwright also did the screenplay, which I think helped. And one of the things you get concerned with, especially if it's somebody fairly new at doing screenplays, is, well, just like directors, there's usually a little bit of overindulgence. And an example I think of, even though it's not a new time writer, but as much as I love the film version of Doubt, there was quite a bit of symbolism that you know, tested one's patience between leaves and feathers and owl, that sort of thing. And I think the biggest symbolic moment for me in the film, it comes at the very beginning. Nicole Kidman is working in the garden, and when the neighbor steps on the flower and breaks it.
Yeah.
After that, it's pretty standard for it. Now, without giving too much away, the Kidman and Aaron Eckhart are the couple, and they're both, well, one is grieving, the other is not. And there's a moment where the mother winds up seeing the boy who accidentally ran over the son, and that's played by Miles Teller, who I have to check and see what else he's done, but he really, really gets to hold his own. Nicole Kidman has, you know, kind of been on a, well, less than impressive streak after winning The Hours, and I'm sure she's got other things in her life going, and, you know, but films like The Golden Compass, The Invasion, and Stepford Wives have just not even come close to what she could do. This is her best work probably since The Hours, and as I alluded to earlier, using the Ice Queen persona that she's been able to do for 15, 20 years and really work it out. And nice to see Eckhart doing something else even. I got worried Eckhart because of In the Company of Men, and then especially with Thank You for Smoking was going to get kind of typecast in the yuppie hell, kind of like Christian Bale 10 years ago. And he's also really solid in this, is playing a fragile father. Also, Diane Weiss is in here as the God-fearing mother, and just solid performances across the board.
Yeah, really terrific. When we were doing our balloting for our Indiana Film Journalists Association Awards, I openly lobbied for Diane Weiss for Best Supporting Actress. I think she end up getting the runner-up award?
I believe so, yeah, because it was Miss Steinfeld's year. But,
yeah.
But
yeah.
It was because really, Diane Weiss has been doing, I mean, she's been a working actress, and of course she has two Oscars already for Bullets Over Broadway and Hannah and Her Sisters, and she's been able to bounce between stage and screen and television and is doing just fine. But it was nice to see her in something that she could latch on to really, really good in this part.
And, you know, it's one of those roles where she has, you know, she's kind of, you know, flits in and out of the movie, you know, makes an impact, but, you know, not necessarily, you know, it's more about setting up the other characters. And then she has this one extended dialogue scene where, you know, she's talking for like a good 5 minutes. And it was like, you know, worthy of an Oscar nomination just based on that one scene.
The Beatrice Straight moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And Aaron Eckhart is great. You know, the interesting thing about, you know, the basis of the movie is about the relationship between these two people and how does that survive and change and evolve after the death of a child. And you see them struggling together, and you also see them struggling apart, you know, in their own ways. I mean, she's very much internalizing things, you know, trying to hold back on her emotions, doesn't want to be flinging, you know, big emotions around, right, especially these group meetings that he wants to go to.
And the group meetings are, well, they're at times very funny and other times very painful, for depending on your attitude, I think, about group meetings.
And Sandra Oh has a nice role as one of the organizers of the group meetings. And she and the Aaron Eckhart character end up having a flirtation.
And a joint.
and they get to smoking pot before every meeting to loosen up. And, of course, you know, that obviously leads to other things. But it's so understandable of why that temptation is there for him, just because here is a woman who, you know, openly wears her feelings and her loss of her child, you know, on her sleeve. It's all out there. She's not afraid to confront it. You know, I'm trying to remember, is the character's name Nick? I'm trying to remember.
I think so.
Yeah. You know, he just has this need for empathy. And so you can see how he ends up identifying with this woman, and that, you know, he ends up having that connection with her that he just at that time can't have with his wife.
Yeah. So, by the way, it's January. It's cold. Go see it. It's definitely worth checking out.
As I put in my review, it's, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, it's a depressing movie, but watching it is a joyful experience.
Yeah. If you enjoy really, you know, well-made, well-acted. And I talked with an actor who was in the production, and the question he had was, do you see it? And I was able to tell him, I'm not giving anything away, almost is a way of putting it. And then that's where, you know, the difference between plays and movies, obviously. And fortunately, James Cameron Mitchell picked just enough of the moment to show and not show in this case. But yeah, it's raw and it's gut wrenching. And as much as we love Blue Valentine and Rabbit Hole, don't see them the same day. I'd say at least give yourself 1 or 2 days apart before checking each one of them out.
Yeah, and what an amazing transition for, is it John Cameron Mitchell?
John Cameron Mitchell. And he was a director for hire, as he said in an interview on NPR.
Yeah, I mean, he started out with, you know, he was basically the guy, one of the main guys behind Hedwig and the Angry Inch from its stage roots, and then did Short Bus, you know, a drama we were talking about, you know, a serious drama with unsimulated hardcore sex. And then he makes this movie, and I don't know, it's completely unexpected. But I mean, honestly, I think he just knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, I think it was one of those. I think when we saw it on paper, we went, "He's directing this,
right,
really?"
Exactly. On paper makes no sense, and you watch his movie because his real strength is working with actors and dialogue, and so that you just absolutely in those moments are just so invested with weight and authenticity.
And as I heard on an interview, which you could probably hear on NPR.org, but he also lost a brother when he was very young. So there was something about an emotional attachment to the subject matter, which I can totally understand. And hopefully this helped him out as well, because this is a fine film to go check out.
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay. Also opening in theater. Now we got the heavy stuff out of the way. Now we'll get to some lighter fare. Finally in theater. No, not finally. I think they actually really wanted to release this in January as opposed to Season of the Witch, which has been on the shelf for a while. But The Green Hornet is now available in 2D and 3D. And it stars Seth Rogen as Britt Reed, for you fans of the radio show, comic, TV, animated. I don't know. I don't know if they make animated versions of this, but you know, he's the title character. Jay Chou, I should say, is in this as well as Kato, Cameron Diaz, Tom Wilkinson, Christoph Waltz, and Edward James Olmos, and some 3D stuff.
So this is what you want out of your life. Living legend inside of a Smith and Wesson, sliding out of the. This gives you a sense of fulfillment.
Drink.
I spend all night writing about the corruption of this town.
And you do nothing.
For today's top story, newspaper mogul James Reed was found dead, leaving his son in charge of his media empire.
Sorry to hear about your father.
Hey, Kato, you knew my dad pretty well, right? Now that he's gone, I'm thinking I haven't done anything good my whole life. I'm not sure what I should do.
Wanna see something cool?
Whoa! You did that? What did you think of my father?
Was a complex man.
Think about this, Kato.
You
We've been completely wasting our potential. The city needs our help. We could be heroes. Here's what will make us different. We will pose as villains to get close to the bad guys. That way, no one will suspect we're really the good guys.
I want you to take my hand. I want you to come with me on this adventure.
I'll go with you, but I don't want to touch you.
Okay, you don't have to take my hand, but will you come with me on this adventure?
Okay.
Yes.
What do we call it?
The Green Hornet.
I'm Lenore Case. I'm the new secretary.
Perfect.
I want the head of the Green Hornet, and I want it tonight.
You know who you are? You're a human Swiss Army knife. Just when you think there couldn't be any more cool things, a new thing comes out. What's this?
Is it gas gun?
A gas gun?
How does it even work?
Let's roll, Kato.
Red light, stop! Stop!
Camera got us. Can I shoot one?
As we said at the beginning of the show, we tend to get leery of films that are released in January because they're released in January for a reason. And originally, I was like, okay, it's another superhero comic turned into a film. But there's a couple things that I met my expectations that I hope for. Well, one, Seth Rogen, who stars in it, is also a co-producer and also co-wrote the script. And Rogen apparently knows his comics, or at least the 12-year-old's version of what a comic should be as far as making a comic into a film. The other fascinating part is it's directed by Michel Gondry, who gave us Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Be Kind, Rewind, Science of Sleep. So he's not an action director, and at times it just kind of shows, but there was a part of the tone of the film that I liked because there was part of it where, the Seth Rogen character, Britt Reed, is trying to create a character. So in a way, it's kind of a slacker version of the first Spider-Man film where he's testing out costumes and ideas and doing all this. What I especially liked was the relationship between Britt and Kato. There's a ongoing thing about, are they a team, or is it I'm the hero and you're the sidekick? Or if you're a woman, I'm the Mary, you're the Rhoda from Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. So there's that thing of, you know, arguing over, especially because he's kind of, Kato's like the Watson of the group. This is a guy that builds the cars and beats up everybody in elaborate slow-mo action style, you know?
Well, it's the joke of the movie, I think, is actually supposed to be that Kato, in fact, is the Sherlock Holmes, and that
Britt Reed is Watson.
Is Watson just sort of coming along and saying, that's astounding, but everybody gives Watson credit, you know, so it's like, let's call Watson because he's, you know, and doesn't acknowledge that he's got that Sherlock Holmes guy tagging along who actually does everything.
Like the first scene where they thwart a bunch of bandits and Kato just whoops all of them after, as they're all lying on the ground, Seth Rogen comes over and kicks one guy and runs off.
Yeah, and the other joke is that Britt Reed, you know, as the Green Hornet, doesn't, you know, acknowledge even to himself that this is the case. He really seems to think that no, he's the main guy, and Kato is helping. When in fact, Kato is the whole team, and he's sort of like the mascot.
And then he comes home and says, "That was amazing. Awesome."
Yeah, I mean, totally, it's a strange movie. I know you liked it.
I did.
This movie is really split, you know, critics just here.
Not just
within
us,
our group.
But I mean, I've read stuff online, and
yeah, I know from our group. I know Nick Rogers really liked it. I know Joe Shearer liked it. I know I didn't care for it. I know Bob Bloom didn't care for it. The reviews have kind of been all over the place. Read Roger Ebert's review.
I did.
He had a really funny thing where, you know, he said Seth Rogen, you know, as the writer, gives himself way too many lines. And he says, it feels like there's parts where he just said, you know, the CGI department will insert 9 minutes of, you know, computerized action here, whatever it may be. I don't know what it is, just here.
So why didn't you like it?
Well, what I said was, you know, I'm all for a movie that's a spoof of the superhero genre because I think it's certainly rife for spoofing. But you know, I think they were trying to do something with the movie, and I don't think they accomplished what they were setting out to do. I think they were trying to make something that was a really, really funny movie, and then it ends up being this movie with a whole lot of nervous energy and just reams and reams of dialogue, where I think you heard there were Seth Rogen is just, you know, stuff is going and he's just saying it, it just keeps pouring out of his mouth. But I mean, did you actually really laugh at this movie? I counted one time. I genuinely laughed out loud at the movie, and it's the very last scene, which I won't reveal, other than to say that, you know, that Kato and Britt take extreme methods to preserve the fiction that the Green Hornet is a villain and not
right.
a hero.
I laughed a few times, and one part in particular that I liked as far as the tone is, and this isn't giving away in any, but there is eventually a fight between Britt and Kato, and it's done as a combination of, you know, your kind of typical Asian action film, and then just bad fighting, like two guys hugging each other up
right.
on the floor,
and
not getting a punch in.
It's an amusing scene, but the thing is, we've already had a bunch of scenes prior to that in which we've demonstrated that the Kato character is, you know, just a martial arts god. So, you know, in reality, this fight should last 3 seconds,
him
if
hit,
that
him,
long.
Him hit
yeah.
the floor.
Yeah. I do want to point out a couple of things about the movie. I was just mentioning to you, so you know, the Black Beauty in here, which is the awesome 1965 Chrysler Imperial,
which is now my daughter's top wish list for Christmas. Thanks.
Right. Interesting thing. They are actually quite desirable, but not as collector's cars. So people aren't buying these up and restoring them. They're actually buying them up to smash them up in demolition derbies, because apparently these things were built like tanks.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually read an article about demolition derbies a few years ago where 1960s Chrysler or Chrysler Imperials, very highly desired as demolition derby cars.
And this thing is, I mean, Rogan obviously, as I said before, tapped into the 12 and 13-year-old movie audience big time with this picture, between the gadgets. You know what? I hate to admit this, and I like looking at Cameron Diaz, but she's got crow's feet in 3D.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of...
Do they come out at you?
Almost. And Michel Gondry, to his credit, there's a couple of moments that he's able to use 3D for something else other than, you know, a flying body part, which is in Piranha or something. And I think of the scene where the word of mouth about going after the Green Hornet.
Yeah.
So little moments like that. I admit, I think the film really gets off the rails by the time we get to a car chase scene that involves the newspaper office. And that's just chewing up lots and lots of money.
Yeah. And the whole, the Christoph Waltz character, I just think didn't work. I mean, for me, his name's Chudnovsky, and the joke is supposed to be that he's very flat and not interesting and dresses all in black and just he's boring. And then he tries later in the movie to jazz himself up.
This is like you and I talking about Machete. That's exactly why I like it, because he is a villain with an identity crisis. And then he tries to come up with something, and even his henchmen are going, oh, that. And then one guy's going to get killed because he knows. He goes, that's a terrible idea.
I don't know. It's a movie in which the villain's plight is that he realizes he's too boring. But it turns out that making a movie in which the villain tries not to be boring just ends up being boring.
But he's got a big gun.
He's a big gun with two bros. Also wanted to point out.
What?
Green Hornet, one of the very few superheroes, at least fairly well-known superheroes, who did not originate in a comic book. Started as a radio show.
That's right.
Then became a couple of cheapy movie serials, and only then did it debut in comic book form. And then, of course, most known to probably, you know, anyone, you know, age
us and slightly older.
Yeah, for the 1960s.
Not you, Kobe.
1960s television show co-starring
Bruce Lee, yep. Which, by the way, the daughter noticed the scene where Kato has a notebook and he makes drawings, designs, and she caught that there was a portrait of Bruce Lee in the thing. So, well,
dang.
Dang is right. So I enjoyed this, and see it in 3D if you must.
Now that was a good movie.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Wow, that was a long stretch. That was good. We're going to take a short break. I'm going to play a little musical interlude for you, and we're going to get to what's new on DVD and a tribute to director Peter Yates. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
Summer holiday, no more working for a week or two.
they're on a summer holiday. No more worries for me or you, or a week or two. We're going where the sun shines brightly. We're going where the sea is blue. We've seen it in the movies. Now let's see if it's true. Everybody has a summer holiday, doing things they always wanted to. So we're going on a summer holiday to make our dreams come true.
Sir.
What?
Are either one of these any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs. You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store!
Hi, I'm Robert Irvine, and you're listening to Film Sociology, WFI in Indianapolis.
Thank you, Chef Robert. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. This show is also available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap is here. Kobe Slagle's hanging out with me as well. We had to take a break because I just ran out of adrenaline. But but you also saw the new Ron Howard film, The Dilemma, or Vince Vaughn and Kevin James just making it up as they go along.
Yeah, with Jennifer Connelly and Winona Ryder.
Yeah, Kevin James is married to Winona Ryder in this one. Aren't you happy?
Oh.
Aren't you jealous? Wasn't King of Queens enough for this man?
Yeah, but an interesting pairing, though. Two Oscar-nominated actresses. Did Connelly win? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, for Beautiful Mind.
Yeah. So with Kevin James and Vince Vaughn, who will never, either of them, be anywhere near Oscar gold.
How was it? Because this whole, you know, should Vince Vaughn tell his best friend that his wife's cheating on him?
Yeah, it's not hella bad, but it's pretty bad.
won't make the poster.
Oh,
not
man.
Hella bad.
I'm going to cut that. I will cut that. That's going to be...
That's for the show.
Yep.
Thank you, Christopher Lloyd. You are now a part of Film Sociology Legend. You already have
awesome.
Been, but... That's great.
It's just a typical Vince Vaughn movie, you know, where he does that sort of
verbal
diarrhea thing where, you know, he's on the merry-go-round and he just can't get off and he's talking and he's doing his thing.
What do you do with this and what do you do with that?
And the most un-Ron Howard-like movie
I've heard that.
Just because, I mean, Ron Howard did start out in light comedies, you know, Night Shift, Splash, that sort of thing.
Eat My Dust.
Yeah, but... not just, you know, his change from, you know, more sober Oscar bait kind of movies. It's so generic. I mean, it literally feels like you could have just driven down, you know, Hollywood and Vine and just, you know, run over any three or four, you know, second tier directors and they could have made this movie and it would have been any different.
I'm sorry, Chicago, because, you know, Vince Vaughn's linked to it, so it has to be. He is Chicago's Ben Affleck. Sorry, Chicago.
Quick aside, because I know we...
Yes.
So their whole deal is that they're car guys and they're trying to make a deal with Chrysler, you know,
to make it less gay cars. We heard in the trailer that they pulled.
Been some controversy about that. The less, his words, not mine, less gay electric vehicles. So they're taking like, Dodge Challengers and that sort of thing. And they're putting electric engines in it, but they're putting like speakers under the hood. So it sounds like a muscle car.
See, I know you are a car guy, as we heard earlier with your information. So did you just yank your hair out after hearing that moment?
But, you know, my attitude is if you want to have a big block, if you want to have the sound and power of a big block.
Grow a pair and get a big block.
Get a big block. You don't fake it with, you know.
A Prius.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, a Prius is a Prius and there's nothing wrong with being a Prius. But, you know, don't pretend to be, you know.
Wow.
And if you want to hear what a real engine sounds like, I'll be happy to rev up my Mustang with a 351 Cleveland 4-barrel for you.
He will too, and he's actually talking about a car. So let's take that. So, and we'll get to the music in a little bit. Also, starting tonight at the IMA, if you don't have plans at 7 o'clock, it's okay, it happens. But starting tonight is the Winter Nights film series at the IMA, and film noir is the theme. And tonight they are starting with Criss Cross. No, not the bad 90s Goldie Hawn thriller that was set in Florida. This is with Burt Lancaster and Yvonne DiCarlo. That's right. She was quite a dish back in her day. 1949. I know you love that term. Don't
See,
you?
With the crisscrossing, I thought you were going to talk about the kids wearing the pants backwards.
You would bring that up. You're not even old enough to remember them.
Mac Dowd will make you jump, Matt.
Don't ever recite those lyrics on this show again with your Pacers basketball t-shirt. Let's see. Also in is Key Largo, which is a must-have. And by the way, I think that's your next Google assignment, Kobe.
What's that?
20-year-old Lauren Bacall. Yeah. Also, that's Key Largo's the 21st. Stray Dog, which is a Kurosawa film, one of my faves, and it's at that time, 1948, I believe, it's a Kurosawa cop drama about a police officer who loses his gun and has to find it. I know, but he makes it riveting. That's January 28th. Kiss Me Deadly with Ralph Meeker, directed by Robert Aldrich. I'm using the phrase from a cable channel, movies for guys who like movies. That's Mike Hammer, who's just going to stomp all over you like Derek Rose on a bad night. And just so that is February 11th, Detour, which is February 18th, and it's a nice change of pace, but still within the theme, Memento on February 25th. So that's at the Toby Theater, $9 to the public, $5 for member. IMAMuseum.org, 923-1331 for more information. Also on DVD and Blu-ray this week, my top pick for the best film of 2010, The Social Network, our pick, which is David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin making the most exciting film about creating a website and talking with lawyers.
Yeah, really amazing to think about the movie, because it's a movie in which almost everything that's happening is it's legal depositions, people sitting around the table giving legal depositions in a pair of lawsuits.
Yep.
And nerds hunched over computers, blaming out code. Seriously, that's probably 80% of the movie right there.
And hanging out with Justin Timberlake.
Yes, exactly. And it's absolutely mesmerizing.
And it helps because it's Aaron Sorkin, who's probably going to get a screenplay nomination, definitely did, and David Fincher, who I know a lot of people kind of gripe that he got a bone tossed to him for Benjamin Button when he should have had it way before that for Zodiac.
Yeah.
Well-deserved this time around with this.
Agree. Fantastic script by Aaron Sorkin. He will get nominated. He will win. Write it down.
Ooh. You hear that? No, and no foot fetish at this show either. That's
what?
NFL playoffs. Don't worry about it.
Rex Ryan reference?
Yeah, I did it. I did. Sorry. And you're wearing your Pacers shirt, so. But, yeah, I agree. And, by the way, for those who are, you know, special features nerds, pointing to self, David Fincher gives some of the best commentary on a DVD in the business. David Fincher, Kevin Smith, regardless of the film, although I don't remember if there was a commentary on Cop Out. Hopefully not.
Oh.
Just 90 minutes of explaining himself. But, no, Fincher's films, the guy's had a hell of a track record already, and he's only getting started. I mean, I'm actually intrigued with the Americanized version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He'll do something with it.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting. But, yeah, fun listen. But definitely, if you haven't seen it in theaters, is it completely out of theaters now, I think?
I think so, yeah.
Well, I guess.
Maybe it's some second run
theater somewhere.
You know what?
I wondered if that is probably going to be, if it hasn't already died already, is usually every year there's like one or two films that are considered for nominations and they kind of put it back in theaters, and I guess Social Network isn't going to be one of them. But,
just because of the video release date.
Exactly.
Who's going to go?
Right. You know. So, no, go rent this. Even better, go buy it.
Yes! 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 Yes!
And also, just making a note, also on DVD and Blu-ray, but it's not in 3D. It's Piranha.
No, it is in 3D.
It is in 3D.
I got the 3D Blu-ray, although, of course, I do not have a 3D TV, so I can't verify how great it looks. But...
or how weird the thing floats, because there's body parts and bouncing other body parts and bitten off body parts.
I will confess, I put it into the player just to and fast forward to the infamous scene that my partner Joe Shearer at the film insisted that you have to see just because it's so ridiculously trashy.
And?
Yeah, that part is actually,
not hella bad.
That part is okay. It's really actually forgettable. It's the part right before it where what's the actor's name? Jerry O'Connell.
Jerry Romaine.
Yeah, where he's or half of him, I should say, is spread eagle on the boat. And you get just this wonderfully graphic look at his bottom half or what's left of it after the piranha have done their thing.
Wow. Thank you, technology.
Thank you, technology.
That's great. Also on Blu-ray this week, Dances with Wolves. Goodfellas is still better. And Black Robe is... yeah, I can't let that go. And by the way, Black Robe is a better story, better film with the same storyline, the Bruce Beresford film. But also, and I got to double-check my... This is one of those... I wish they sent it to me. But two, I want to see if there's just as many special features on the Blu-ray as there is on the DVD. But I still adore Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, his lone non-Western. It's a Jewish mobster film with Robert De Niro,
James Woods,
Elizabeth McGovern, a 10-year-old Jennifer Connelly. 10-year-old Jennifer Connelly. We'll make a list of films that you really shouldn't watch too long. Joe Pesci, and it's just a great score by Ennio Morricone, and it's a great kind of go. And this is the original version, the full length version, because I remember when the movie came out, they released it as at 2.5 hours, and the critics destroyed it.
Yeah,
and then finally, through the power of constant griping, it got released in a full 3 hour, and it's just masterful, just a wonderful, wonderful film from Sergio Leone, and his last for that one. Also out on Blu-ray, Rob Roy, if you like to see Liam Neeson and Jessica Lange walking and doing things on rocks, and then him later fighting Tim Roth. That's always fun.
One of the all-time great sword fights in cinema ever.
That is they're doing it too. They're fighting too. Yeah. None of this, you kids with your green screens and your fake swords and all that. Speaking of as real as it can get, one of my all-time favorites, and I also need to double-check this for special features on Blu-ray, Raging Bull.
Yes.
If you like The Fighter and you haven't seen Raging Bull, get cracking.
Yes. I was fortunate enough, I received the 30th anniversary Blu-ray of Raging Bull. And unfortunately, they sent it to me the day that it hits the street, so I wasn't able to write anything for my website in time.
And yet you watched the floating thing in Piranha.
Well,
Joe killed him too.
All right, I'm busted.
I understand. You know, watching
priorities.
Watching a man believe he is immortal, even outside the ring, and some of the most brutally shot fight scenes in history, and a floating thing.
All I'll say in my defense is that I have a 3-month-old at home who never stops eating, and I have a pile of discs to watch that's literally my arm length high.
Well, hopefully a piranha won't bite it in half. The arm, not the thing. All right. Before the break, actually, I want you to, instead of taking a break, let's play this music under, because I would have played this. But you heard that during the break, the song Summer Holiday by Cliff Richard, and this is not because I brought it up with Robert Irvine last week, but director Peter Yates died this past week at the age, I think, 81. And quite a career. And there's something about a director who is able to have a diverse career. His first film was the Cliff Richard musical Summer Holiday. And for those who don't know, Cliff was kind of the English Elvis. He had a couple of songs that charted here in the U.S. in the 70s and early 80s. But a film I actually liked. It's actually well shot by Peter Yates, and the choreography is by Herbert Ross. So it's not just 2 hours of English kids twisting at a disco. But then, of course, what you're hearing under this is the theme by Lalo Schifrin, written by Lalo Schifrin. This is somebody else doing it, but it's a theme from Bullet, 1968, Steve McQueen, real car chase, one of the best. And we could probably do an hour on car chase films. Maybe we'll do this soon. But Steve McQueen at his baddest.
Steve McQueen did a lot of the driving for that thing, and they absolutely destroyed the engine. They got like one of the first editions of the 1968 Mustang before they were out available to anyone. And they, the engine in that was just absolutely wrecked when they were done with it.
You're the car film consultant for this program now. And
cool.
Bullitt's the only thing that makes, I mean, it looks, making a downshift 12 times in a row just look cool as hell.
Yeah.
And this is also a film that won Best Editing and well deserved. I'm going to make sure I have a couple titles on there. The Deep, probably the best use of a t-shirt in cinema history. Jacqueline Bisset, Kobe, look it up. How old was I?
Days of My Youth.
I was 7. Yeah, that helped a lot. But also, he did John and Mary, which was a drama with Dustin Hoffman and Mia Farrow. Murphy's War with Peter O'Toole. The Hot Rock with George Segal and Robert Redford. Friends of Eddie Coyle, which came out on DVD by Criterion last year, I believe. A really underappreciated crime drama with Robert Mitchum and Peter Boyle. Mother, Jugs, and Speed. Where else can you have Bill Cosby, Raquel Welch, and Harvey Keitel in an ambulance comedy? The Deep we talked about. Now, for you Indiana folks, he also directed 1979's Breaking Away. That's right. Dennis Christopher, Dennis Quaid, Daniel Stern, Jackie Earle Haley, all cutters, all riding bicycles around Bloomington during the Little 500. And before Hoosiers, I heard Breaking Away was the story where like 9,000 people have all claimed to be extras in Breaking Away, you know, that sort of thing. And it's a really cool film about growing up.
One of the most distinctly Hoosier movies ever made.
I mean, it is.
Other than Hoosiers, probably.
And Boys Don't Cry. No, I'm kidding. Just 30 minutes out of the city in any direction. The 1981 thriller Eyewitness with Sigourney Weaver and William Hurt. So we're bringing up all these titles. And then he did Crawl, which Joe completely forgot about on Facebook. And I love the fact that he went from Breaking Away to Eyewitness to Crawl to The Dresser, which I remember seeing in the theater with my dad. It's a great performance by Albert Finney and Tom Courtney. Finney is a Shakespearean actor who's really, the cheese is really falling off his cracker, and Courtney is the title role. You've never heard that phrase either?
I've heard that once.
Let's see. Elaney, Suspect with Cher, Dennis Quaid, and Liam Neeson. The House on Carroll Street with Jeff Daniels. An Innocent Man. Year of the Comet. Roommates, that's right, with D.B. Sweeney and Peter Falk, and of course Curtain Call was the last film I saw of him, but a really nice career and a nice diverse selections of music.
Mentioning one there from 1992, Year of the Comet, William Goldman, in one, you know, he's written, I think, 3 different books about his adventures in screenwriting.
And this is Tim Daly and Penelope Ann Miller chasing a bottle of wine.
Yeah, and he has a whole chapter, I think, in one of his books about, you know, them making Year of the Comet. And it was just one of those things where, you know, they thought they had bottled magic and, you know, they didn't. And he's very forthright about, you know, why is it sometimes movies work and sometimes they don't. It's not a bad movie. It's actually, you know, has some charms to it, so worth a rental maybe.
Yeah, so you have, well, let's see, a great car chase, great t-shirt scene, Raquel Welch and Bill Cosby in an ambulance, and Albert Finney, and that cool ninja star thing that's in Crawl. So not a bad legacy for a filmmaker.
Yeah, kind of an understated career in that, you know, he was never, you know, a Scorsese, a Coppola.
Right.
Somebody said, like, you know, we've got to have Peter Yates. He was more of a journeyman. He was somebody people hired to be a director, but very well accomplished. And, you know, I don't think you would ever say he made a bad movie. I mean, you had like Crawl and you had Year of the Comet where, you know, things weren't clicking. But I mean, I think
he was a competent filmmaker.
Oh, by far.
Exactly.
And when he was hitting on all cylinders, like with Breaking Away, which is just such a wonderful movie.
You haven't seen Breaking Away yet, have you, Kobe?
If you live in Indiana and haven't seen Breaking Away, wow.
There he is, right there.
Got to rent it.
I went to IU and didn't see Breaking Away.
Yeah. See, you hate film, and you hate Indiana, but you love white basketball.
you're gonna tune in, and then
when they win tonight?
Yes, and when they win, I'm gonna text you and
text
say,
me.
Ha,
they
told you
fine.
So.
You text me.
Pacers have beaten a lot of the elite teams.
Yes, I know. They beat the Lakers in what month?
They beat Kobe.
Didn't they beat the Spurs?
Didn't they? Guess what? None of this really matters until playoffs.
Yes.
So, all right, Kobe, hit us with the music. Your segment.
Time for What is Kobe Watching?
What is Kobe watching?
And in all honesty, Kobe, I'm still looking for my copy of Bullet. It's actually in my Steve McQueen box set. So, I wanted to get you something with Peter Yates. So, you get The Friends of Eddie Coyle. Now, I'm warning you, Kobe, because you've alluded to this a few times. It was made in the 70s.
Things were different.
They were more patient. So be patient with the movie.
The 70s, horrible clothes, great movies.
Yes, and some people would even say, and I even read, you know, some folks talking about how Bullet is a really, really flawed film and a slow film until you get to the car chase. So anyway, give that a shot.
Okay.
It's a Boston crime movie before The Town and all the other Dennis Lehan novels that were made into movies. So,
and I've still got Tommy.
You still have Tommy.
But we did see Raising Arizona.
You did see. We'll get to that. And last week, of course, we paid tribute to the great character actor Pete Postlethwaite. So you get The Usual Suspects
to watch.
So now, last week, yes, you still have the Ken Russell musical Tommy. Because you need to see Anne Margaret rolling around in baked beans. Everybody should. Maybe before you see Breaking Away. But you also watched Raising Arizona, which I'm still stunned that you have not been. We're trying to get him in touch with his inner Coen brothers. Sir, your thoughts?
Loved Raising Arizona. Loved everything about it.
It's a crazy funny film.
It is.
And you know what? You don't have to say, I liked them when they were early funny films.
Because
it's the damn Coen brothers. So, I remember taking a date in high school to that film, and that's how we were going to have children. We were going to steal them from guys who own furniture stores.
My name is Nathan Arizona.
And I'm on my knees, an honest man asking you to be my wife. Howdy, Kurt. Also, one of the most quotable films. If this was a college radio station, we could probably do an hour at least on movie quotes, but we're public radio, so we're not going to do that. But we could. Chris, your thoughts on Raising Arizona?
Wonderful movie. I remember seeing it. I don't think I actually saw it in theaters when it first came out, but it was probably the first Coen Brothers movie I saw. I think I saw it before Blood Simple.
Okay.
And it's just so off kilter and so different. And really kind of the breakout performances for Nick Cage and Holly Hunter. Yeah.
Yeah.
And hate to say it, it sort of... To make a strange connection, a movie like Breaking Away, when I think about it, not just how much I love them, but how sad I am that those sorts of movies probably wouldn't get made today, or if they would, it would be on some small, tiny indie that wouldn't get an audience.
Exactly. And by the way, last week I saw Season of the Witch, so I miss young, not in debt Nick Cage.
See, I didn't see that. I may have to try and sneak out just because it's the sort of... I mean, it's sword and sorcery, and I'm a total geek for that stuff.
Really?
Did you
enjoy... Totally. So in the early 80s, Conan, Sword and the Sorcerer...
Oh, Your Barbarian from the Future. Oh, yeah.
And, what was the other one? There was Sword and the Sorcerer, Conan... Oh, Beastmaster.
The Beastmaster.
Were you a Beastmaster guy?
Beastmaster is kind of corny.
Eric Singer and Tanya Roberts in loincloths and a bald John Amos. Oh,
yeah.
That's...
So I may have to go see Season of the Witch just because it's exactly the sort of trashy movie that I like.
You know what? It's a cop film. If you really think about it, it's Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman are the two cops that are taking the star witness to a court case, basically. It's 16 blocks, only she's a witch. And she turned me into a newt, and I got better.
Yeah.
And try not to quote Python when you're watching this film. That's all I'm saying. Chris, plug your book and plug the film you have.
We were mentioning Bullet. I should also mention another great Steve McQueen car movie that probably most people haven't seen is Le Mans from 1970.
Boy, he really wanted that movie to be made.
He really did, and it's kind of a self-indulgent movie.
But
it's still enjoyable if you're a car guy. Featured in my book, Reeling Backward, One Film Critic's Journey into the Past, which... As of this week, now available on Amazon in either downloadable Kindle form or as a print book. So just go to Amazon, Reeling Backward, find my book.
And here's some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Chris, thanks for hanging out with us this week.
Thank you very much.
Kobe, enjoy basketball as much as you can.
Yeah.
And if you, go see American Masters Jeff Bridges if you haven't, and go buy it. Maybe they'll repeat it in your town, but keep looking for it. It was a lot of fun. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.